My name is Richard Downey. I'm Deputy Director of the Africa Programme at CSIS, where we've just completed a year-long project looking to stress test 10 countries across the African continent. I'm joined by Jennifer Cook, Director of the Africa Programme at CSIS, and she led this project. Jennifer, perhaps you could begin by explaining what the overall purpose was of this project, what we were trying to do here.
Yeah, the origin of the project came out of really in the aftermath of the Kenya post-election crisis in 2008, and I think which many people failed to anticipate and were surprised by. And I think we were asked really look ahead 5-10 years, what are the other places that might surprise us, the places that are ostensibly stable, but where we may be missing underlying vulnerabilities.
So what countries are on the list?
So we looked at 10 different countries, beginning with Angola, Botswana, Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, Rwanda, Senegal, Uganda, and Sudan, which obviously is not ostensibly stable, but got thrown in the mix simply because there's a lot of vulnerabilities to look at. So ultimately, I think as we were concluding the study, the events in North Africa and the Arab Spring came to light, and I think, in some ways underscore the importance of looking at looking ahead a little bit and seeing what we're missing in terms of vulnerabilities and potential for instability.
Okay, so there's 10 pretty diverse set of countries on the list there, as you suggested. It's always problematic to try and make comparisons between them, but are there any common sets of vulnerabilities?
Yeah, I think there's some general trends and general stressors that all countries face to a certain extent. Particularly in Africa. Some of these are kind of sub-national identities, whether they're based on regional or ethnic identities that may have been manipulated over time or historically. The question of demographics, changing demographics, growing youth populations, many of whom are moving to urban centers where grievances get more concentrated, and issues of climate change that then drive land scarcity, water scarcity, and so forth. So all of these countries face different stressors, but in some ways, what makes vulnerability is not only the stressors, but the capabilities of the various countries to manage those stresses.
So if we were to try and, in a kind of unscientific way, place all these countries along a line with the most stable countries on one end and the least stable on the other, where would we place our 10 countries? Give us a sense of where they come out.
Well, it's not scientific at all, obviously, but I think among the less vulnerable countries, we would put Botswana, Ghana, and Senegal next. In the middle, Kenya and Nigeria and Angola, perhaps, and towards the perhaps more vulnerable side, Uganda, Rwanda, Ethiopia, and then obviously in the midst of vulnerability, which a pretty obvious vulnerability, Sudan.
Right. I should point out that we did two reports in essence on Sudan, breaking the country in half to reflect southern independence in July. It's noticeable in that sort of spectrum you laid out for us that the democracies tend to be on the stable end of the spectrum and that the more authoritarian regimes on the less stable end. Is there anything we can draw from that? What's the reasons for that?
Well, again, the two components of vulnerability really are the stressors and then the ability to manage that and be resilient in the face of that. So places like Ghana and Senegal, they certainly have stressors, and we've seen, for example, in Senegal, recent protests against constitutional changes that President Wade has wanted to put forward. But the fact is that there's a lot of resilience there. There's a democratic history. There's civil society. There are outlets for grievance. There's ways that the country has found to manage and compromise and negotiate political competition. Kenya and Nigeria in the middle, very volatile, lots of kind of shocks and crises to the system, but over time they've really managed to find ways absorbing those kinds of shocks without stressing the overall country. Really, on the more authoritarian side, you find regimes that really have not come up with ways of managing political competition and grievances other than patronage, for example, or coercion. And it's those countries in some ways that we're most worried about going forward, that ultimately when grievances accumulate, you know, and there is a break, it could break in very unpredictable and possibly violent ways.
Although a sort of paradox, they look stable from the outside looking in many ways, but as you say, they can kind of collapse and fracture easily, I guess.
Right, in a way they're frozen where they are, whereas in the countries on the less vulnerable side, there's a general sense of forward momentum towards greater participation, not less.
One of the things our authors looked at in each of these reports was what some of the common triggers were for instability in this set of countries. Do they differ between the democracies and the non-democracies?
Well, there are some common triggers, and economic shocks would be one of them. Fuel prices rising or food prices, obviously you see a rise in public grievances, but also additional stresses on the governments to deliver to their citizens. But really the succession issue becomes a potential flashpoint. In democracies, ironically, elections become a flashpoint where a lot of the issues otherwise unaddressed become crystallized in grievances and so forth. In the authoritarian countries, again, succession becomes an issue there because there's so little opportunity for political expression. Elections, whether fraudulent or not, or the question of a leader changing the constitution to stay on, challenges from within the ruling party against an individual who's been on too long, all of those are more likely to trigger instability down the line.
I guess a final word about the implications for the United States in this study. You know, one of the things that comes across strongly in the reports is that some of the countries that we're perhaps most worried about in terms of long-term stability are close allies of the United States. I'm thinking of Ethiopia, Rwanda, Uganda. Does this have an implication for the way that the U.S. Defines its policy towards these countries?
Well, first of all, we shouldn't take their stability as guaranteed is one lesson. And we saw that in Tunisia and Egypt, that you do have to look a little deeper, look at institutions, look at the nature and the strength of the social compact within that country, which takes a little more nuance than simply, you know, stability indices usually convey. So looking a little deeper at that is important on a country-by-country basis. A number of those countries, all three, in fact, Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Uganda, have posted fairly good economic growth rates, and I think in some ways their governments have staked their legitimacy on development rather than political competition. And sometimes we say, look, okay, they're not the most open countries, but you know they're doing well economically. That's really more important. I think we have to question that assumption too. And in terms of the security relationship, I think we really have to make very clear kind of the parameters and the limits of our partnership with these countries, that we do have a pragmatic security relationship with Ethiopia, Rwanda, Uganda, for example, but we should make clear that that does not mean an open-ended embrace of their democratic values, for example, and we also have to recognize that their people have aspirations that their governments may not be meeting.
Jennifer, thanks. We've not time to go through all the findings of the reports, but you can read them all yourselves, all 10 countries, plus an overview paper which ties together some of the common themes. All of it on our website at csis.org/program/Africa-program. Thank you.